It's the third episode of the Wander Well Living podcast, where we go over the highs and lows of life and the intricacies in between. And in that vein, we talk to inspiring individuals to chart us through their paths through life's complexities. Thank you, Gokoku Vegetarian, for sponsoring us today. Over in North Hollywood, the best vegan sushi you've ever had. I'm your host, Shaka Smith, and we have a very special episode. We have three inspiring individuals in celebration of AAPI Heritage Month. First up, we have a two-time Emmy winner who went from broadcast journalism all the way to creating content with over 100 million views, working with TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube as a content creator, Miss Jackie Fern. Next up, no stranger to an Emmy, we have a playwright who's hosted for Variety for over 20 years and has also brought us inspiring stories from the biggest entertainers. We have Janelle Riley. And last but certainly not least, we have a man that has been photographing celebrities since he was 17 and working for People Magazine, 17 Magazine, and he's photographed the likes of the Kardashians to Britney Spears. We have celebrity photographer David Lee. Woo! So glad to have all of you join me today. I really have wanted to talk to all of you for so long, so it's great I was able to get you all in one room at the same time. I know how busy you guys all are, so thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely, absolutely. So first up, obviously it's AAPI Heritage Month. I wanted to talk to you guys about how that shaped your early childhoods. Did you have a moment in your early childhood that led to the future path you've decided to take? I'll start with you, Jackie.
Okay, thank you so much for having us. This is such a great episode for Asian Heritage Month. So for me, a very early formative childhood experience that really shaped this creative path I was on was being told no by my parents. Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm first generation and my parents are from the Philippines. And when I came here, I really wanted to be in entertainment. I am actually from Los Angeles, from the Valley, 818, don't hate, you know what I mean? And they did not understand what that meant. So I felt a natural pivot instead of being on TV, especially back then, you didn't really see people on there. People growing up now, they have like Crazy Rich Asians, they have like EXO Kitty. I mean, there are so many different avenues, but back then it did not seem possible. So for me, something that was so formative is that I thought the best natural pivot would be TV journalism. And then from there, get to pivot to entertainment. And that's actually the career path that I took.
Wow.
Mine's very similar, and I'm curious, Mine's very similar, and I'm curious if either of these two were big influences, but I remember Connie Chung. Mm. I'm probably older than you. Like, the first time I saw her on TV, and I thought, not only was she the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen, I was like, she kind of looks like people in my family, and literally nobody else on TV did. And then as I got older, it was Lisa Ling. Seeing her on The View, you know, at that point, I don't think I was really registering how maybe a lot of the other women looked alike, or, you know, that there was something about her that stood out. I just knew that I sort of gravitated to her. I think I was always like, oh, someone with dark black hair, like, because we I haven't seen much of that growing up in Oregon. I think that's why I always liked Lois Lane. so yeah, those are like the earliest markers I can remember.
Yeah, how about you, David?
Well, I'm a third generation Chinese American. My grandparents are from China, and my parents, my dad grew up in Hollywood. My mom's from Nebraska, so my parents were always really encouraging to me as to pursue my passion and just get out of the house and do something. So one of my first memories was when I was 14. And Kiss FM was really big back in the day. It was 1996. And so I called Kiss FM, and I won two tickets to the Rick D's Kissmas party. Whoa. And then they sent me these two passes, and they were just laminated passes. So I was like, these are so easy to copy. So So I copied them, and I ended up bringing my whole family. So I brought my parents and my two younger sisters, and guess who performed that night? It was Labuja. So after stepping inside that room and seeing all that creative energy and the exclusivity, you know, way before social media and everything, I was just like, I need to figure out how to keep this going. I want to go to more parties.
Keep printing fake passes. That's how you do it.
Yeah, then when I was in when I was 17, I won a writing competition for Scholastic, and the prize was $5,000 plus writing. Then I was able to write articles for 17 magazine. Mm-hmm. So then I asked my editor if I could cover the Teen Choice Awards for her, and she said, sure you can, but, and then I told her that I had a digital camera. So she asked me if I wanted to be the official digital photographer of the Teen Choice Awards. Wow. And this was 1995. And when I got there, I was the only digital photographer and the only Asian in the whole entire award show.
Wow.
So from that experience to now, I actually just went to the Gold House award show, and now we have a full award show just for Asians. So it's just it's amazing how far we've come.
Yeah, that was the next thing I want to talk to you guys about is representation in your various industries. I know you went from broadcast journalism to content creating, so that's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And then you've been in the theater and then also hosting on the variety side. And I guess you can also speak to what you've seen from the films and TV shows on that side, if diversity has actually changed, have the behind the scenes changed as well. And same for you, obviously it's been a huge change for you. But yeah, we'll start here.
With me?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've noticed a huge change because when I started in broadcast journalism, I was often the only news anchor in these white newsrooms. So I was the first Filipino Chinese news anchor in Cleveland, Ohio. And this was just in 2016. This is not like a long time ago, you know what I mean? And same with like North Carolina. There was only one other one, and she worked for a rival station. And then Tampa, Florida. I remember there was this feeling in Tampa when I was a news anchor there. I walked in, and the one other Asian news anchor who I had seen before at like journalism conferences, we saw each other, and we were like, "Oh my God, so good to see you!" And then after hugging, she goes, "Are you here to take my job?" Because it felt like there could only be one. And yeah. I was like, don't worry, girl. I'm mornings, you're night. Like, don't worry, we're good. But I feel like that was only just a few years ago. And in that time, the landscape has changed dramatically from whether it's like TV news or even just watching Netflix. Like, there's just so much more representation. And that feels like a really great thing because it feels like your dreams of being a creative are more attainable. And then in content creation, that is where I feel like a lot of Asian folks felt like they could take autonomy over their own like identity and their own career, which was to pursue digital. And in that sphere, Asians are, I feel, are very much like the majority of people who have figured out a way to take digital careers and make them money makers. And so, yeah.
I just want to say, if we're relating this to the entertainment industry, I'm so excited because literally right now down the street, Ming-Na Wen is getting her star.
Oh, like, wow.
Yeah, I know. And she's one of those people that everybody loves. I mean, I don't know how many people, if anyone, can say they're a Disney princess, they're in the Marvel universe, they're in the DC universe, and they're in the Star Wars universe. You know, and she's someone who I think, like, even knowing how much everyone loves her and how great she is and she's getting this great honor, is kind of underrated.
Yeah.
Like, you know, why is she not Meryl Streep level? Mm-hmm. Why is she, you know, she showed me she still has to audition for roles, which blows my mind. Right? Mm-hmm. Like you don't know what she can do. She can literally do anything. So that just fills my black little heart with joy today. I mean, we're coming off a year where obviously Everything Everywhere All at Once swept the Oscars. And I remember seeing that movie a year ago. I actually did a Q&A with it for opening weekend. and looking around and thinking, God, I love this movie, and it feels so specific to me. I wonder if anyone else will like it. Mm. And I remember that first Q&A having two thoughts. One was, you know, I think this movie's going to do well. And the other was, I know everyone's talking about Michelle Yeoh, but you know, the guy from The Goonies, like I think like this could get him some jobs.
And lo and behold,
of course, goes on to sweep award season. And I'm loving the representation. I feel like, you know, back in 2016, there was that meme, or I don't know if you call it a meme, but it was the hashtag starring John Cho, where they put John Cho into like as a leading man into all these different movies, and it was kind of amusing and aspirational, but now I feel like it's real. Like, I keep banging the drum for the new James Bond to be Henry Golding. And I can't, and people don't look at me funny. They go, that's a great idea. You know, and then suggest their suggestion, which is usually Dev Patel, which I'm not opposed to either. Or Riz Ahmed is the other one hear a lot. And I just like little things like that when I know, like, you know, I have friends who are mad when Zendaya was going to be Mary Jane in Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, and now they're totally like, yeah, Idris Elba should be Bond. So makes me happy.
And for you, I guess you said you've seen such a sea change, you know, in your career. Have you seen, I guess, not drawbacks, but times where the industry has receded? And how did you deal with that?
Well, it's just being an Asian in environments where there's not a lot of Asians, you just have to keep on, going. You have to keep on asking for things. And you get a lot of no's, but the more no's you get, the more empowered you are to just do what you want to do and live your passion.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say career-wise, what has been the biggest hurdles you have experienced because of your heritage? And for you, with content creating especially, I wonder, because it's such a new space, yes. And I'm wondering if you're already seeing those sort of like constructs of power, you know, manifest themselves in that space as well.
I would say, to speak transparently, I feel like in the digital world, there's this idea that anyone can go viral at any time and you can build this brand just like that. And you see it so often where, you know, if TikTok presses the heater button on a certain creator, they just like blow up, right? Yeah. But I've noticed that that is a false idea, because that heater button moment typically only happens with white creators, you know? So I find that though it's like, whether if you're anything besides white, those like moments of virality that translate not only into virality, but actual money making, business building things, mm-hmm. brand deals that are six figures are very, tough to get and challenging to get as creators of color.
Yeah.
I feel like I only ever hear white people say, I'm going to make a viral video. And I'm like, but you haven't gone viral. You haven't shot the thing yet. Why are you so confident it's going to be a viral? Oh, right, because.
And I think people don't talk about that a lot. People think like, oh, you can just go viral. It's so easy. And we've seen a lot of like other creators of color, they go viral as well. But there's that other next step mm-hmm. in turning that person into a brand. And I find the people and the companies that want to invest in creators to want to elevate you to that next thing, they have a very specific creator that they're thinking of.
Yeah. Still a hurdle.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, it's interesting, because when I grew up in a very small town in Oregon, and I was one of two Asian families in our high school. And I was always felt very much the other, you know, people. The funny thing was, people would try to insult me, but they couldn't come up with very good insults. So they'd be like, oh, yeah, luau girl, because my family's from Hawaii. And I'd be like, yeah, I spend my summers in paradise. What's the joke? You know. But when I came to L.A., actually, I think that like a lot of people felt I was passing. because my dad is Irish, my mom's Japanese, and suddenly someone who was like who was so ethnic in Oregon, mm-hmm. actually I get mistaken for a lot of different ethnicities out here, or people think I'm white. So sometimes I feel like I actually have to like kind of remind people that I'm Asian and I'm interested in these stories, and you know I'm always just sort of reminding people like, hey, I'm here too, and I wouldn't mind covering this, or think of me if you're doing, you know, an AAPI panel or something like that. And people have been really receptive to that. Something else I've seen change that is great is, I'm talking years ago, not with my current employer, and not even a place I used to work for, but you know, they have these sort of round tables where they put on a bunch of different actors to discuss, you know, maybe it's like an Emmy actors, or maybe it's like actors who produce or something like that. I remember one year a friend was putting together a round table and they had an Asian on it, and there was another Asian they wanted to add, and they were told, well, you've already got one.
Oof.
So we've ticked that box.
Wow.
So it's covered. And I don't feel like I hear that anymore, which is encouraging.
Well, Asians have always been typically behind the scenes. And when I first started taking pictures, I was behind the scenes. And I would be doing photo shoots with celebrities, but then sometimes I wouldn't even take pictures with them. Like when I was doing my photo shoot with Lady Gaga, it was just me and her. And then I just didn't even think about recording any video or taking any pictures, because I was just like, oh, I just want to be behind the camera. But now we have opportunities like this, thank you so much, where we can actually get our stories out there and show what the behind the scenes is. So I think things have changed a lot.
Yeah.
So tell us more about behind the scenes with Lady Gaga.
Yeah, right?
Lady Gaga. So this was actually her first magazine cover shoot. Yeah, and it was for my magazine. It was called TD Inc. And I was working with Universal, and they told me that there was this this new artist, and they said that she's going to be the next Madonna. And then I was like, okay, it's not like the first time I've ever heard that. Like, everybody said that.
That's right? Why you didn't take video, right?
Yeah. So then they told me to go to Area Nightclub, you know, on La Cienega.
Yeah. Right.
And then I met Lady Gaga there, and the manager let us in, and it was just me and her. No manager, no publicist, no agent, like nobody. And so I started with an interview with her, and I asked her, what kind of music do you do? And then she said, I do pop. And I'm like, okay, pop like Britney Spears? And she's like, no, pop like German down-tempo house music. It's like, okay, that's interesting. And it was just magical, because we were just like hanging out, and I was telling her, you know, go over there, wear that. And something like that, it's not going to ever happen again, because she's so guarded. So
I can vouch that won't happen. There's a lot of people that come with her now.
Yeah.
She's still so lovely. She gave me love life advice once.
Oh.
Yeah. I didn't take it. But listen to Lady Gaga. My life would have turned out very differently if I listened.
Well, she's so amazing. And then 4 months later, she just blew up. And then that was that. So
I'd love to get, speaking of advice, your advice, mental health-wise, when it comes to these hurdles we talked about. I mean, as a content creator, if you feel like you're struggling against getting that heater button pushed, how do you decide to invest this time and money and maybe a career change into doing that?
Well, I would say for me, you know, our month also happens to be Mental Health Awareness Month, right? And so when I was a news anchor, I remember my friend, she told me she was in therapy, and I was like, oh my gosh, girl, you weak. Like, what the heck is wrong with you? And but then I noticed, because in my family, you don't do that, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like in a lot of first-generation families, the idea of going to therapy is just really seen as weak. You keep your struggles to yourself. You bury them under the carpet, and you just, like, keep going on.
Yeah.
In Filipino culture, culture, you really mask your trauma with jokes. One of my favorite professors, she wrote a book, Asian American Psychology, by Dr. Laura Uba, and she was able to categorize each person in the Asian diaspora. Mm-hmm. And it is psychologically proven that Filipinos tend to be the ones who kind of like use humor as their coping mechanism. And so the thing with my friend is that I saw a true change in her from doing therapy. So then I explored it. So it really takes that one friend to be vulnerable to tell you like, hey, I'm actually starting therapy. And because of that, she has changed in me, not only myself, but future generations, because I've been in therapy for so many years, so many years, guys. And I have to say, it has been a huge relief, because when I was a news anchor and the only Asian person in those white spaces and being forced to be the knower of all things Asian, like, I remember people would ask me like, so do you know, can you explain to me like North Korea, South Korea? I was like, I don't effing know the history of like their war. And so I was like, I don't know. And so dealing with that, working with a therapist to help me through all those struggles and challenges and how to react to situations like that has been so helpful. And then in the content space, which is so different, you're very alone as a content creator, right? You're typically making content alone, and you feel so much of your self-worth is mired in the views and the statistics and the analytics and how much you're getting for a brand deal, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like when you work with a therapist through that, it can help you to remember that that is not who you are, it's just what you do.
Yeah, your worth.
I relate to that so strongly, because I remember, you know, growing up, you know, always being told that, like, you know, take care of yourself or you're weak. Mm. The weak was the word I really, really rhyme with me. I got very, very sick in college. I've always had really bad obsessive compulsive disorder, and at the time I first had it, I didn't really know what it was until, again, I'm dating myself, but Donahue actually did a special on it. And I was like, oh, so like not everyone walks up and down stairs 9 times or flicks that light switch on over and over again. And then I couldn't get anyone to believe that it was a real thing. Yeah. Like, nowadays, we know this. We accept it. It's like half the people seem to have, you know, their little quirks. And it wasn't until I got very physically ill and I had every test done known to man trying to figure out what was wrong with me, doctors kept saying, like, have you considered a therapist? Have you considered, you know, have you tried going on Prozac? And I remember just going, like, no, I just need to get a hold of myself. Right. And they put me on, at the time it was Prozac, and it changed my life. It really did. And I stopped having these, you know, stomach pains. I stopped having these panic attacks. And I remember, but that still wasn't enough, because I was like, well, when can I go off it?
Yeah.
You know, so that I can be strong on my own. And then I finally saw a therapist who's, and I've had good therapists and bad therapists over the year, but this is the one who really kind of saved my life, because he said, you know, he's like, you have a medical condition. Mm. If your liver was failing, no one would say, you're weak, get over it. Mm. No, they would expect you to get surgery. They would expect you to need help, to need medication. And he's like, it's the exact same thing. So there's like no shame in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, now again, that sounds like, I think we all know that. And like, thank God people are like talking openly about it.
Finally.
But at the time it was like a whole new world to me. And I remember, you know, starting to think, okay, I'm not weak. And, you know, especially growing up in an Asian household where it's, you know, we didn't hug a lot. And, you know, we wore kept all our emotions kind of tamped down. But we did use that dark humor too. So, I relate very strongly, and I'm grateful, honestly, that I got sick physically, because I don't, and it still comes up like every few years. If I'm not, you know, taking the time to meditate or manage my schedule, my body lets me know, you know, by making me very sick. And then I'm like, okay,
now
I need
the
to
time.
Step back. Yeah.
How about you?
Now, I grew up in Hacienda Heights, which is a suburb of LA. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with all first-generation Taiwanese. So my high school is Taiwanese and Mexican. So naturally, I would hang out with the Taiwanese because I look like them. But I really didn't have anything in common with them. And one is just like the generational thing, and also it's a different type of culture. And so when I had that opportunity to go to the Teen Choice Awards, I asked all my friends if they wanted to go with me, and they told me that they didn't want to go. So it made me think that there was something wrong with me because I wanted to go, but nobody else wanted to go. Mm. So right there, like, there's like a lot of, that was causing me mental illness because I don't know why I wanted something and nobody else wanted it. Mm. So, and then as you get older, you're just trying to find out like where you're, what your tribe is, where you fit in. And I'm also a Cancer, so I'm very sensitive to energy. And when I'm around different people, I absorb it. But one way that I've been able to really move forward is through meditation. Mm-hmm. And with meditation, I could just, you know, I meditate at least an hour a day, and it just really clears my head out. And then I get to clear all that crazy energy that I get from other people. So. Yeah. That's how I deal with it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of meditation, big fan of journaling, huge. I know in the industry there's a pressure sometimes to conform, you know that code switching. What was that pressure like? I mean, especially broadcast journalism, hosting. What was that pressure like for all three of you, and how did you balance that pressure? And then did you find some sort of level of authenticity you were able to sit with? Anyone?
Yeah. Go ahead. So I have found for me, code switching is such a big thing, for real. And so, especially again in these white newsrooms, the first one that I was in, it was Greensboro, North Carolina, and I had come from New York City. So I was raised literally in a New York City newsroom. I'm talking like CNN, where I saw people, the way you speak to other people is just, there is no feeling, there is no sweet talk here. It's like, what the fuck did you do? I was like, what's wrong with you? Like, I saw a freaking man crying because he messed up on the teleprompter. Like, it was just like, you're berated there, right? Yeah. So I went from New York City newsroom, where I'm a very loud, outspoken Asian American female, to Greensboro, North Carolina, and the staff just did not understand my tone. And they were oftentimes like, she's so like, what's wrong with her, right? She doesn't know how to talk to us. And I go, oh my gosh, okay. So I felt not only as like an Asian person, they expected me to probably be a different way, like maybe quiet or like, oh, that's cool, guys. Like, yeah, I'm just happy to be here. You know what I mean? And I would just say like, what happened there? Yeah. The grammar is wrong. You know what I mean? And I had to learn to really sweeten up the tone to be received. And that was very weird. I felt like being in a newsroom, and you might get this too, I was just asked to be so many contradicting things, right? Like, hired as a super youthful person, but then had to speak in this deep voice to be serious. Had to be like their token exotic Asian, but also appeal to the masses there, which was like a predominantly white and black audience. And it was just so weird, all the things they wanted to me to be, which was anything but myself. Mm-hmm. So that was awkward.
The reason I like following you is you say things that make me remember. I just had like a memory I think I buried for a long time about a college boyfriend who we were arguing about something. I can't remember what. And he was like, he finally said, I thought you'd be submissive.
Yeah.
And I found out later he always had Asian girlfriends. And I was like, oh, okay.
Red flag.
Yeah, exactly. This is so embarrassing, but like I spent years, because again, I was sort of in between, you know, being existing in these two worlds. I had color contacts.
Oh, wow.
I tried to dye my hair red repeatedly. Like, all these things, you know, I tried to change the way I looked so much. I wasn't purposely trying to lighten my skin, but I had really bad acne, and they told me, like, this cream I would use. They were like, it'll make you lighter. And I was like, great. And I would take that stuff on. So maybe it was purposely. And it's funny because it's like all those things now that I'm trying to fight against.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, why am I so pale? And, you know, my hair isn't black enough. And but I talked to a lot of Asian actors, and it's, you know, specifically the women who have all basically said, like, oh yeah, I had the colored contacts. Yeah. You know, I went through that phase too. And, you know, and they often say, you know, this is another funny thing as a journalist, when people who are successful keep telling you something, you finally start to believe it when enough people say it. So many of these actresses would say, it was only when I like really embraced what was unique about me, or like what made me, that I like started to do well, mm-hmm. you know, and also just started to be happier. So trying to apply that more in daily life.
Yeah. Well, I've been a photographer for 24 years now, and I've always had crazy ideas that are very different from what people normally do. And a lot of times people will say, you know, oh, you're crazy, or, you know, you can't do that, or that's against the rules. But I just figure out a way to do it, because that's something that I want to do. And it's like, as I get older, people will either start helping me or they don't help me. And then, but in the end, it doesn't really matter, because it's just all about whatever I want to do, and I have to make it happen.
Yeah.
So that's how I do things.
Did you guys have moments during, like, as you said, you found it was better to be more authentic, be yourself. But what was that moment like? How did that change for you? Like, how did we get there? You know, if you're someone who's out there and you're kind of in that world, what do you start doing and say to yourself to say, tomorrow I go in a little bit more like myself?
I think when you're starting out, and especially if you don't come from like a rich family, you're not a trust fund baby, oftentimes, like for me navigating these spaces, I was like, I have to keep this job. Like, I have to make money. You know what I yeah. mean? And especially venturing out into an industry where my family had no idea what to do, et cetera, et cetera. I was almost defying them by pursuing TV journalism. Yeah. And so for me, a defining moment was actually in Tampa. It was almost like one of the last mic drop things I did. So Tampa, you know, is in Florida, and it is a very, like, it's a red state. And so there was a white man who claimed to be transracial and said he was Filipino. He identified as Filipino. I think he was, like, saying he, you know, just like claiming he was that.
Yeah.
And so everyone in the newsroom kept asking me, what do you think about that? I was like, I don't know. I need to like do some research. What's going on with this person? And I ended up doing a commentary that was on air, like a 90-second, a minute and a half commentary speaking about how problematic this is. And again, this is in a Tampa, Florida newsroom where only the black assistant news director, she is the one who gave me the encouragement and the green light to do it, versus everyone under her who was white was like, you can't say this. And I was like, she approved it. Like, she approved it. And I called out white privilege, how it reeks of white privilege, how this is problematic, how, you know, this man is just so many different things that is like wrong. And it was honestly the most scary, liberating thing I ever did. You could hear a pin drop in that newsroom, but I said it, and it was the last thing I actually did in that newsroom.
Wow.
Yeah, I did it, and then they were like, okay, cool, we can tell you're not happy here. You can be let out of your contract.
Wow. We'll pull up the clip right now. I wish we had the clip. Wow. Did you have a defining moment like that?
It was actually kind of similar. It was, you know, comic book fandoms have very strong opinions, and a lot of them maybe aren't, you know, the warmest to women of color, women of a certain weight. I remember it was fairly recently. I did like this panel with like three white guys and me discussing a certain superhero movie. And the funny thing was, I was the only one that liked it. And I'm a total comics nerd, so I knew my story, so I'd be like, no, this is from the book, and this is... And these were just three guys who were like, oh, it's stupid, or, you know... Actually, I mean, they were well-spoken, and they had good points, but I was sort of brought on to be the person saying, like, no, this actually, like, you know, has some history, and this is why they did that, and da-da-da-da-da. And yet every single comment was, the girl is stupid. The girl is ignorant, you know, and it was like, no, the girl's the only one who actually has her facts straight and knows her history and, you know, is actually defending the thing you love, and yet I'm the bad guy here. And, I mean, there had obviously been tons of, you know, experiences like that along the way, little things, but it was like, it was so vivid to me. I was like, ah, oh, there's something they don't like about me. I can't put my finger on it. And like, I'd be lying if I said it still doesn't like hurt me or upset me to see that, but like, I'm just getting older too, and I just care so much less, you know, what people think. I still do have that thing where like, oh, I have to, you know, I have to play nice, I have to, you know, work with these people, but the older I get, it's like, I, you know what, I have enough friends. I don't need everyone to like me.
Yeah.
So, getting old and cranky is my advice.
How about you? I guess you've always, to some degree, been able to call the shots. Was there a moment that surprised you, and then you had to walk away?
Yes. Well, one time I was doing a photo shoot, and so, as a fashion photographer, I'm always working with a lot of women. And this one time I was doing the shoot, all these women started ganging up on me. And I just got so, I was just so angry because it was just like my opinion didn't matter, but I'm the photographer, so I can't really do what I wanted to do. So then I ended up pulling the designer into the other room, and I pretty much just yelled at her, and I made her cry. And then I told her that I'm leaving.
Yeah.
And then she's like, then she begged me to stay, and then everything was fine after that. But yeah. It was something else.
Tell me about, I guess, that power of no and standing up for yourself. What does that look like, and how has that developed?
Sure. I'm going to be honest. It's hard for me. Yeah. It's hard. I've been a people pleaser, and, you know, I'm always the one who's, like, trying to keep the peace, and it's still very hard for me to stand up to myself. Usually, as soon as I do, I feel really bad about it, even if I'm in the right. And then, luckily, I have, like, some really great friends that I can go to and say, like, here's the situation, you know, was I wrong? And they'll be honest. Yeah. You know, if they witness something, they'll be like, no, you were out of line, or... And of course, a lot of the time, I'm the one telling the story, but I try to be fair as a journalist. I try to present both sides, and I'm still getting used to it. Weirdly, I was saying earlier backstage, I had a really bad neighbor who lived underneath me for a while, and she was crazy racist. But the funny thing was, she couldn't figure out what ethnicity I was, so she'd call me like Wuhan. You know, and I'd be like, no, not quite. Or like, then she'd called me a slur for like a Latino person, and I'd be like, oh, getting colder. You know, and I realized at a certain point, because I kept trying to deal with her, and I felt bad for her and reason with her, and you just couldn't. She was just, I'm sorry, especially as someone who's like a mental health advocate. She was just miserable and crazy, and she wasn't going to change, and she wasn't interested in it, and I had to kind of learn to be mean to her because it was the only thing she responded to. Mm-hmm. Trying to reason with her, trying to tell her like, hey, can you know, she didn't, the whole thing was she didn't want me showering after 10 p.m. Well, she didn't want me showering at all, which that was the whole thing. So she didn't want me running any water in my home after 10 p.m. And, you know, after, it took like 2 years for me to realize like, she's just going to complain. She's going to scream things. She's going to be out of line. The only thing she responded to was if I screamed back. Oh. And I hated it, But then I started to get a little good at it. And I don't enjoy screaming at people anymore than I did before. But like, and I try to choose my moments, you know. And often if I do lose my temper, I'll immediately apologize. But I'm getting better at it, which I don't know if that's a good thing or not.
Well, sometimes people come in our life for a reason. Maybe she's there to help you.
No, my friends have said, like, I know you, and you're going to feel bad for standing up for yourself, and don't do that.
Yeah.
So trying to get better.
Work in progress.
Like, about owning it, yeah.
How about yourself, David?
For me, it's like I just learned that you have to really choose your battles. And when you have to, it's all about alignment. So you have to look at your core values, which could be, you know, it's like your integrity, your passion, your drive. And if something doesn't fall in line with that and it's really bad, then you should stand up for yourself.
Yeah.
But sometimes things are just like too much to handle and it might be better to walk away too. So
sage advice. How we talk about hurdles, I want to talk about opportunities, positives. How has your heritage brought opportunities or positives, and how have you been able to utilize that for your own career?
I find for me sometimes, like, for example, I know that the first news anchoring job I got is because they thought that I would be very appealing to both the audiences in there, so I felt like it very much was a token hire. And so that was an opportunity that was, I realized that was the case later on into the contract. I was like, oh, they basically hired me to be like that person. And so I feel like sometimes those opportunities, and that's like for broadcast.
Yeah.
And as a creator, I find that last year for me as a creator, during Asian Heritage Month, it felt like my freaking Super Bowl. I was like, whoa, all these brands are like so wanting to work with me because it's like they need to fill that quota for like Asian Heritage Month. And so I was like, if the check's clear, it's all right with me. You know what I mean?
It's so true. Like, you know, for whatever reason that you ask me to do a job, you know, I'll get up there and do it, and hopefully, you know, you'll like what I do, and you'll have me back. So, there are certain opportunities. The one thing that kind of springs to mind is, shortly before the pandemic, someone organized a group. We don't have a better name for it. We just kind of refer to it as Journal Asians, and it's journalists who are also Asian. And yeah, we're working on the name. And it just never occurred to me, you know, and then like getting to get together with these people and share our stories and realize, oh, it's not me. Like some people are terrible. And also like, you know, clue other people in. There's a great theater company in town, East West Players, mm-hmm. that, you know, is very AAPI oriented, and like elevating those voices and looking out for those people and just sort of being in the know. And it was just a community that, like, I didn't really know I was missing.
Mm-hmm.
The pandemic obviously put a halt to everything, but we're starting to, like, get back up. And I just love talking to these people.
Amazing.
I've been involved with the Asian community for a long time now. So my very first internship was for the Rafu Shimpo. And it's a bilingual Japanese newspaper, and what I would do is the writers would send in their letters, like handwritten, and I would type it up for the newspaper. And over that really showed me, you know, that showed me community, and it was really inspirational because I got to see a bunch of Asians doing something. And then as I got older, you know, I would get these other opportunities with shooting Asian celebrities. I just did a dream project where I did a shoot for Guo Pei. So she's known as the most famous designer in China. And I shot 20 of her dresses, and these are just like the most beautiful, spectacular pieces. So I think that the reason why I got that job was probably because I'm Asian and she's Asian too. So sometimes you get the jobs because you're Asian, and sometimes you don't. So...
Something that you highlighted was, you know, AAPI month, you got all the brand deals. I know that myself from February. how do you deal with it if you are wanted because of your ethnicity or your heritage, but it feels disingenuous? And how do you evaluate, you know, whether or not the opportunity is an authentic opportunity to reflect your heritage?
So for me, when it comes to brand deals, I think something that's so cool, like for last year for Asian Heritage Month, all these brands wanted to work together, and it was very specific, like, oh, what's your favorite Asian movie or whatever, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine. But I think what's more exciting is when I actually get brand deals with brands that I love, and they have nothing to do with my ethnicity, and things that I'm able to pitch to them are things about my culture. So, like, for example, I have a brand deal with Corona, and one of the sketches that I pitched them was how my mom's, like, Filipino recipe for boiled peanuts uses Corona as, like, the secret ingredient. And I was thinking, like, oh, there's no way they're going to approve this. Like, that's so random, you know? Yeah. And they approved it. It did well. And for me, I feel like being able to utilize and highlight not a stereotypical, not a caricature version of, like, my culture, but in a really nice way that is authentic to me is something that I'm always going to advocate for with opportunities that I get.
Yeah. You just sold me on boiled peanuts and Corona. That sounds amazing. You know, I have found myself, you know, sort of questioning people's motives a lot in recent years. You know, it's like, oh, suddenly you're aware that this is an issue. And then I'm like, maybe you're overthinking it. And you know what? Just take the opportunity, at least in my situation. A lot of times, especially, not now, but, you know, when I started out in theater 20 years ago, a lot of times they needed a token woman, you know, or, you know, a token ethnic person to be on, you know, when they have these, like, short play write-up sort of things. And part of me would kind of be like, hey, and then I was like, well, just do it. Do a good job, you know, and prove that they were right to ask you. And, you know, hopefully open the door for people down the line. And maybe that's, like, maybe that's just me being selfish and choosing not to think about it. But like I said, I don't like confrontation, so I don't know. I don't know what I would have said. And I find so often that people, they want to do the correct thing, you know, and if they go about it in a clumsy way, yeah. It's, you know, they really do mean well. Yeah. And so I try to give people the benefit of the doubt most of the time.
Well, as a photographer, I'm really passionate about food, fashion, working with celebrities, and telling stories. So when clients come to me, it just depends if, you know, if I like them a lot, or if, you know, if the budget's in line with my budget, and from there, that's when I make the decision if I want to work with them or not.
Very straightforward. Now, you know, the last few years we've had a rise in Asian hate. I mean, I'm not even sure if it's a rise in Asian hate or, like, we're getting better coverage of it. You know, it's just, it wasn't even covered before. But with that rise, have you guys shifted? Has your career shifted, and in what way?
For me, and especially we were so talking a lot during that time. Like, it was like BLM and then that as well. Like, all so many things happening in the pandemic bubble. And for me, I've always been an activist spirit. Like, in college, I was one of those people. I was in a group called the Coalition to Revitalize Asian American Studies at Hunter College, because they were taking away Asian American Studies as a minor there when Asians were the majority ethnic group at the college. So we were, like, protesting and fighting, and that while also interning at CNN, it gave me kind of planted the seed of, like, activism. Mm. And so when it came to Stop Asian Hate, I really just pivoted, and I utilized my platform to speak out on this. I was speaking out at protests, and kind of piggybacking on the question you said, I find it very easy to stand up for others and to speak out on injustice. But then when it comes to standing up for myself, I find that to be very challenging. So I I'm working on that, like, with my therapist, advocate for therapy. But yes, I found that when it came to that, I definitely pivoted and used my platform to really raise people's awareness about this issue, show them the videos of these hate crimes that people didn't want to see, and again, like, speak out in downtown LA during these protests, especially for the ones for the women in Atlanta. That one really still resonates with.
Yeah, that was a big turning point for me too, because I know, you know, it's interesting because I know a lot of times people feel like, why doesn't everyone care about the things I care about? But I was just like, why aren't people upset about this? Like, why is it not getting the coverage? And, you know, as a journalist, sometimes I feel part of the problem because they're like, the media isn't covering this. And obviously, you know, I work in entertainment media, but still, there's a part of me that is like, you know, we can do better. I do remember not that long ago, but many years ago, someone who's kind of a ancillary friend on Facebook messaged me to say that, like, my, you know, Stop Asian Hate posts were bumming people out, you know? And it's just kind of like, you know, I thought about, this was the same person who actually had told me previously, like, that I shouldn't let people know about my mental health issues because they might not want to work with me, you know? And I thought about it, and I did that thing where I went to friends and said, like, am I the jerk here? Like, you know, it's great to have those people in your real life who can do real lifetime, am I the assholes yeah. with you, you know, and who'll be honest with you. And then I was like, okay, I heard the criticism and I disagree, and like, now I know who you are. It was an Asian person, by the way. That was the crazy thing.
Self-hating yeah. Asian person.
Exactly. I think
with
he was
a white,
like,
husband.
Yeah, yeah. They were like, you're representing, you know, our culture wrong. Like, we need to play nice with people. And it was like, yeah, really eye-opening.
I actually got a lot of that too from other fellow Asians. And I was like, you should be enraged about this. Right. This is you. This is me. That is not, you know what I mean? And so it's very revealing. And I'm just like, unfollow me.
That's what I always say too. Yeah. I did eventually block that person. But weirdly, it was because something weird he said about The Handmaid's Tale was the final straw.
I'm done.
I was like, I can handle your self-loathing racism, but criticize The Handmaid's Tale and we're through.
So one thing that I did was I produced a music video for Stop Asian Hate, and I worked with my friend Johnny Lee with the Hotel Lobby, and I got my my Asian celebrity friends to be a part of the video. Amazing. So they're all holding signs. We had Kelly Hu, Simu Liu, Dante Bosco, the cast of Bling Empire, and It was just a fun project, just to really get the word out, and I think it inspired a lot of people. So I just wanted to increase all that awareness.
That's beautiful, man. Running out of time. I want to have so much more conversation with y'all. You guys have all had long careers in Hollywood and entertainment. If you could give one thing that kind of led to that longevity, you know, that kind of sparked it, or you know, what would that one thing be?
I would say to honestly be able to pivot. And in this career, if you want to be in entertainment, you need to know that there is not a ladder to success. It is a freaking spider web. And there is no path that is clear. So you have to really make your own. And there are, thankfully, for like younger people coming up, there are so many blueprints, right, that you can follow and make your own, whether it's like a Mindy Kaling or a Quinta or an Issa Rae. Like, these are all so inspirational people who took nothing and created empires, right? Yeah. So I feel like for me, those people are my inspiration. And then the one thing I would love to give advice is be okay with flopping. Flop, 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 flop. Like, have a flop era. But if you can be consistent in your cadence, if you want to be a digital creator with all like 000 views, that is going to build resilience in you. And when it does hit for you eventually, it will be a goldmine of your spirit that will be able to receive what you're getting.
I started off in improv comedy, so I'm so familiar with flopping. And one of the best gifts that a teacher ever gave me was to say, like, don't try to be funny. Just try to be true to the rules and get comfortable with failing because you're going to do it a lot. Funny, I don't do improv that much anymore. I wonder why. My advice is probably to be your own biggest advocate because no one's going to give you anything. You know, there might be people who help you out, but like I remember, like in high school, everybody thought I was crazy that I wanted to go work in Hollywood, or like even when I came out here, some of the projects I wanted to do, like there was nobody backing them or supporting them. I didn't have a lot of, you know, not from like, you know, the higher ups and like getting my shows up, you know, things like that. So I had to sort of find my tribe and find the people who would support me and just do it. And, you know, and I had people who would tell me this is a terrible idea. You know, the first like real significant production I directed, the way that the designers spoke to me versus the male directors who had just as much experience, if not less than me, it was interesting because men started to notice. And that's when you know it's bad. Because they would be like, huh, I can't understand why he's talking to you that way. Like, and you see them start to put the pieces together, you know? And I felt really bad and I second-guessed myself. But I was also, at that point, all in. So I was like, just keep believing in yourself because there's going to be times when other people won't. So you gotta have your own back.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's all about passion. And first of all, you have to find your passion. Once you find your passion, you just have to keep on trailblazing. You're gonna get the word no a lot, but it's better to hear that word no, because once you get that yes, it just feels so much better, and you just keep on moving forward and building your career one level to the next. But if there's no passion, there's no reason why you should even try it.
Very true. Well, I want to thank you guys for being here. This was an incredible conversation. Just again, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great job.
Thank you for being a great
thank
audience.
You, everyone, yeah. For being here.
Thank you.
Yay!
Well, thank you guys, and join us for the next episode of the Wanderwell Living Podcast.